I am Dr. Anton Bilczyk, Nadia's older brother.
And I'm the younger sister, Nadia Bilczyk.
We are inundated with misinformation as it relates to healthcare. And what we are trying to do with this podcast is to have a discussion based on facts, based on peer review publications, based on credible sources.
So join us so that you can live long, live strong, and live healthily. Well, a very good Saturday morning, Saturday afternoon, evening, wherever you are. I'm Nadia Bilczyk, talking to my brother, once again, cancer surgeon and researcher, Dr. Anton Bilczyk. Anton, I'm so delighted we get to do this again.
It's exciting.
Last week, we spoke about Princess Kate's cancer diagnosis and treatment. This week, in this week's episode, we want to talk about the importance of early detection. And I know that is a huge area of your research. How important is early detection of cancer? And what do we look out for?
So it's a really excellent question because people often ask me, when should I go see a doctor, or what symptoms should I look out for that suggest cancer? And I think a lot of people think that every cancer comes with a symptom. So, for example, if it's colorectal cancer, it comes with rectal bleeding. If it's stomach cancer, it comes with, you know, throwing up blood or weight loss. And the reality is that most early cancers come with no symptoms. And that's really the reason for screening. I mean, why do we get screened? Very simple, whether you're getting a mammogram or a colonoscopy, it's to detect lesions that are precancerous, such as in the breast. If it's some calcifications that are ductal carcinoma in situ, which is a precancerous tumor, or a polyp in the colon, which has the potential to become cancer, then that can be removed and the treatment is pretty straightforward. Also, the purpose of screening is to give you some reassurance that that everything is normal. So It it seems kind of, you know, obvious that cancers don't necessarily come with symptoms, and yet many people will only get screened once they develop symptoms.
Anton, I've had a friend who only went to a physician when she already had stage 4 colon cancer. So one wonders, and to anyone out there who knows someone who only goes to the doctor once it's in stage 4, you go, how did she not know before?
Yeah, so that, you know, and unfortunately, I see that quite a bit where people present to me with stage 4. Let's first just, you know, break this down. You know, what does it mean to when someone says stage 1? That's also a very common question people ask, is what stage do I have? Is it 1, 2, 3, 4? What does it mean? And every cancer has a different staging system. So stage 1 means very early. Stage 1 means it's completely curable. Stage 1 means that it's often curable with surgery alone and nothing else. Stage 2 means it's a little bit more advanced, depending on the cancer. Some stage 2s are also treated with surgery alone, but may benefit from some additional therapy, whether it be hormonal therapy, radiation therapy, or chemotherapy. And then you get stage 3, which is a little bit more advanced. And then stage 4 means that it's gone to other organs. So stage 4 means that if it's originated for example, in the breast or the colon, it's gone to the liver, it's gone to the bone, it's gone to the lungs. And stage four means that it's been in your body a long time. You know, typically, if someone presents with stage four, that means they've gone through all the stages to get to stage four. That means they've probably had cancer for as long as 15 years. And once you get to stage four, the treatment is usually chemotherapy first. It usually with stage four disease, once it's more more advanced, don't think in terms of upfront surgery. Now, I think it is important for your viewers to know that even when someone presents with stage four or advanced cancer, that is not a death sentence. That many types of stage four can actually be cured. But it is important to differentiate between stages. And again, the reason one gets screened is you don't want to be the person that shows up with stage four. You want to be either the person that gets screened and gets told by your doctor everything looks fine, or by the way, we removed a polyp, or by the way, there's some calcification in your breast that we think we should biopsy, and then you find out it's benign or it's precancerous.
So what about family history and people who, let's say, have family members who've had cancer, or people who come to you who say there was no family history? What part does family history play? Again, and we're talking about in detection and early detection of cancer.
So I think it's imperative that every person knows their family history. You know, because family history plays a really important role in cancer. There are certain cancers, such as breast cancer, for example, and I think everyone is aware of the BRCA gene. So the BRCA gene is found more often in Ashkenazi Jewish women. And if you are a carrier of the BRCA gene, then the chances of you getting breast cancer over your lifetime are as high as 80%.
Every woman, and certainly every woman of Ashkenazi Jewish descent, are you saying they should get a screening? At what age should they understand if they are positive for the BRCA gene?
Well, I think that they shouldn't. It doesn't mean because they're Ashkenazi Jewish, they should just go and get a BRCA gene. I'm saying that if they have a family member, and when I say a family member, you know, when you ask people, do you have a family history? And they say, yeah, I've got a second cousin or my stepfather, or that does not correlate with, you know, an increased risk. When we talk about family members, I'm specifically referring to siblings and parents. And what's also important is it's not just about siblings and parents, it's the age at which your parent was diagnosed. So if you're Ashkenazi Jewish and your mother was diagnosed with breast cancer at age 45, then absolutely your mother needs to be tested for the BRCA gene. And if you're 25, you need to be tested for the BRCA gene. And again, the reason being, and this whole concept of preventative surgery was something that people struggle to wrap their head around, that you go and have your breasts removed when you have no cancer. Your breasts are completely normal.
Famously Angelina Jolie, right?
Angelina Jolie. And that's simply because with that gene, over your lifetime, you have an up to 80% chance of getting breast cancer. And I think that, you know, what Angelina Jolie has shown people, and she's been very public about this, is that you can have a double mastectomy and it doesn't even look like you've had surgery, because the way breasts are removed now, these techniques called skin sparing, nipple sparing operations with incisions that are made under the breasts, women literally don't, that have had mastectomies, do not look like they've had mastectomies.
So you're saying they keep the nipple intact?
Correct. Yes. They keep the nipple intact. So what that's actually done is women that have early breast cancer, for example, that really don't need mastectomies, will say, well, you know, why don't you just take the breasts off? And you say, well, you don't need to have the breast removed. You just need a lumpectomy. But they have this image of Angelina Jolie.
Yes.
Her name comes up a lot.
Yes, with very, very perfect, magnificent breasts that have been reconstructed to perfection and probably just look like she's had an amazing boob job.
Right, exactly. And let me just take it one step further with family history, because there's another gene called the CDH1 gene, which is associated with stomach cancer. And family members that carry that gene, it's recommended that they have their stomachs removed. Now, think about it. It's one thing having your breasts removed, but can you imagine having your stomach removed in your 20s because you carry a gene that predisposes you to stomach cancer? And there literally are families that have had their stomachs removed that have no cancer but carry that gene. You might ask, well, why would you do that? Well, the problem is that when stomach cancer is detected in those people that carry that gene, it's usually advanced. And the chances of cure are not that great. So that's why this concept of prophylactic surgery based on family history, based on genetic screening, is a very, very important area.
So if you were to write a manifesto to every single person, and let's say, is there an age, what would you like to see in the world of medicine right now in terms of detection, early detection, screening? What frustrates you the most as a cancer surgeon, as a researcher in the area of cancer? What are some of the things that happen? And I know you've had patients, some very high-profile patients, who've come to you when cancer is just far too advanced. What would you like to see happening if you had all the power in the world?
So I'm gonna first answer that question with a question that I get from many patients that present with advanced cancers. And the question is, when did this happen? What caused this? What could I have done differently? And that is a very, very difficult discussion to have, because it's very, very difficult walking backwards.
Yes.
And it's very, very, very difficult to say, well, you should have done this and you could have done this. And, you know, now we're having a very different conversation. So,
amen, brother.
Right. So let's kind of dissect that question a bit. The first thing, which is really obvious, is to pay attention to symptoms. You know, if you are having unexplained weight loss, so I'm not saying you're on Ozempic. Please, you know, everyone seems to be on Ozempic. You're not on Ozempic.
A lot doing it.
Right. A lot of people are doing it that shouldn't be doing it. But you're not dieting, you're not trying to lose weight, but you're losing weight. That is a red flag. Or you're having, if you have a little bit of rectal bleeding and it's bright red, that's most often related to hemorrhoids. And hemorrhoids are extremely common. Almost everyone has hemorrhoids, and every now and then they have some itching or bleeding. But if that bleeding were to persist, so usually with hemorrhoid bleeding, it comes, it goes. But if that bleeding were to persist, or if the bleeding was not bright red, it was dark. Now, if you pass dark blood in your stool, that usually suggests that there's some bleeding higher up, either in the stomach or somewhere else in the intestine. And by the time you pass it, it's dark. That's a red flag. That warrants, immediate attention. It's actually a greater concern if it's dark than if you have an occasional spot of red blood. People usually get more alarmed when, oh my gosh, you know, there's a little bit of red blood and it turns out to be a hemorrhoid. other so-called red flag symptoms are just persistent abdominal pain or stomach pain. Everyone has stomach pain at some point. It can be related to anxiety, can be related to stress, can be related to what you eat, can be related to a gastroenteritis, many different things. But if the pain persists, not going away, that too is a red flag. So there are many what we call red flags that would suggest that you need to go, not wait, you know, a month to see your doctor. You need to go in and see your doctor, because the first thing the doctor is going to do is examine you. The second thing the doctor is going to do is get some blood work. And if you get some blood work and your blood count is low and you're anemic and there's no good reason for you being anemic, and the doctor has your blood test from a year ago where you were not anemic, that's of some concern. That means, you know, one has to figure out what is the source of your blood loss. So symptoms are essential. And then we get to, you know, there are screening guidelines. And it's very, you know, you have to understand that screening guidelines mean you have no symptoms. So if you have symptoms, that's very, very different to when you don't have symptoms. Because if you have symptoms, even if you're young and you're below the age of screening, you need to go see your doctor, and testing needs to be performed. Screening means you have no symptoms. So the only screening guidelines we have right now are in women to get a mammogram at age 40, and for both males and females to get a screening colonoscopy at age 45.
Now,
they lowered it. They lowered it in March of 2021 from age 50 to age 45. Why did they lower it? Well, because we are seeing this epidemic of young people being diagnosed with colorectal cancer. It's probably increasing among young people quicker than any other cancer. And, you know, we're trying to figure out the cause. There are many possible reasons, and you know, I think we'll get into some of those reasons in further podcasts. Yeah, but it's because it's a, you know, I think that for your viewers, there are, you know, really important areas that and changes that can be made in their lives and in their kids' lives to prevent themselves from getting heart disease or getting cancer.
But you spoke about people who come to you and you say, we can't look back. So there was a twofold question. You were saying, if you had the power, you would make sure that every single person, because how often do you go out for dinner or people are having this conversation and they go, oh yes, I'm meant to have a mammogram. I haven't had it for 3 years, or I'm meant to go get a colonoscopy, but let's face it, it's a bloody unpleasant experience. I don't feel like doing it. So are we as vigilant as we need to be? And then to the people who come in, Anton, with stage 4, as you said, meaning it's spread, you say, we can't look back. And that was something, I think, for all of our lives, we can't look back. But it's very frustrating because you, as a cancer surgeon and scientific researcher, you can't take back those years.
You cannot take back those years. And I think, you know, it's a difficult conversation to have, because while, you know, you may know the answer to the question as to how long they've had it for, all the things you could have, it's not helpful. You know, I mean, people really go into a rapid decline about the woulda, coulda, shouldas. And I think that's where we really have to focus on, this is where we're at now. Let's think of the best treatment options available. And please do not lose hope. Let me tell you, hope is a very important part of treatment. I mean, we all hear stories of people who have, you know, advanced cancers who will say, oh, the doctor said I only have 2 years to live, and here I am 10 years and doing just great. You know, and I think a lot of those people have an incredible positive attitude to life. Life does not stop when you're diagnosed with, whether it's stage 1 or stage 4. And it's really important to continue to get into a routine. It's important to continue to exercise. It's important to continue to live as normal a life as you can. because there are studies that show that if you do, you're actually going to tolerate the treatment better and, you know, you're likely to live longer. So, you know, your life does not stop. I mean, I see this all the time, people going, I'm going to have to tell work that, you know, I'm not going to be there for the next 3 months. No, absolutely not. What you need to tell work is that you're not going to be there for, you know, a few hours a day, or there might be days that I don't feel so good, so I'm not going to go to work. But, you know, being around people and actually feeling like you're being productive, you know, helps you with your treatment.
Anton, I'm getting in a question around, what about, somebody's asking me this question, what about if the chemo is so dire and arduous and you're an older person, should you do the chemo and risk feeling sick, or just not do chemo and have what's left of the rest of your life more comfortably?
So I love that question, because it's such a personal thing. There have been studies done where, whether it's a business person, a nurse, a doctor, you know, an accountant, and they've asked them a question: if you had a 2-3% chance of prolonging your life, would you take a chemotherapy that makes you feel ill? And I have my own views about that, which I really try not to, you know, discuss with patients, because again, it's personal. But what the study showed is that more than 50% of people said, yes, we would take the chemo, which I actually found surprising. So I guess you now know my views about that. But I think that, you know, there are some cancers that have an excellent response to chemotherapy, you know, where you can literally be cured by chemotherapy. And there are some cancers where chemotherapy is going to prolong your life by 8 weeks. So, and then there's some chemotherapies that are very toxic, and there's some chemotherapies that have no side effects. So, you know, I'm seeing people that are in their 90s who are in great health, who still are very active, who get diagnosed with cancer and do just fine on chemotherapy. And then I see some people in their 50s who are not very healthy, who struggle through chemotherapy. So I think you've got to take everything into account. You know, what kind of cancer is it? What kind of chemotherapy is it? What are the side effects of the chemotherapy? You know, and very simple questions to ask your doctor. And I think, you know, where one has to be careful with doctors is that doctors use medical terms such as, you know, relative or risk reduction. So just let's just think about that for a moment. And I know we're running out of time, but I think this is really an important question, because I think what your viewers need to ask doctors when they get fancy about using words like risk reduction is just cut that out. Just tell me, give me 100 people and tell me how many of those people with my situation, if they get chemotherapy, how many people is it going to help? Simple question. When we talk about risk reduction, let's say that chemotherapy, so you've got a certain cancer, and chemotherapy is, you know, if you don't do it, then 6 out of 100 people are going to die. And if you do it, 3 out of 100 are going to die. Well, guess what? That's a 50% risk reduction, right? So you hear the word 50% and you go, oh my God, that's huge, versus you're actually having to treat 100 people to benefit 3.
Right. So that makes so much sense.
So really important to ask when doctors and doctors get caught up in percentages and statistics, is ask simple questions that you understand.
So another question we're getting in is around Princess Kate and her so-called, and we'll make this the last question of today's podcast. If you are just joining us, I'm Nadia Bilcik, talking to my brother, Dr. Anton Bilcik, cancer surgeon and researcher in the area of cancer. Our podcast is called Live Long, Live Strong, Live Healthily. It's all around health, early diagnosis, prevention, and things you can do. So the question coming in is around Kate and her so-called preventative chemotherapy. Is there such a thing?
So there is no medical word for that describes preventative chemotherapy. Preventative chemotherapy is a lay term that doctors will sometimes say to patients to reassure them. The medical term is what is, you know, when chemotherapy is given after surgery, it's called adjuvant chemotherapy. So it's called adjuvant, A-D-J-U-V-A-N-T. Adjuvant chemotherapy means chemotherapy given after cancer removal. Preventative chemotherapy is just a way of reassuring someone that your cancer's been taken out and we're going to give you some chemotherapy just to give us some reassurance that it doesn't come back. But there is no medical terminology. And I think what I'm hearing a lot is when doctors are on the news using the word, preventative chemotherapy, I think most doctors in my space are thinking, there's no such medical term that describes that.
And on some of the topics we hope to cover over the next few weeks, let's just think about and share with our viewers and our listeners, what are some of the areas you would like to focus on to really help people understand their health better?
There has been an explosion of work relating to the causes of heart disease, the causes of cancer as it relates to inflammation. And as it relates to all the bacteria in our body, the so-called microbiome. And so trying to understand what that means and what impacts both inflammation and the microbiome, I think is going to be of enormous value in preventing both heart disease and cancer.
So in our next episode, we are going to look at inflammation and we're going to look at, again, what can you do to really understand inflammation? What can you do to prevent it? And again, something you keep saying, Anton, is Googling is not necessarily the way to go. And there's so much misinformation.
Not only is there misinformation, but it's potentially dangerous and can result in a lot of mental anguish and mental stress. And every single person then will, the moment they diagnose with anything, will start Googling. And studies that have come out of Harvard Business Review have shown that up to 70% of what people Google about their own healthcare is inaccurate and not helpful.
Once again, I'm Nadia Bilczyk. And by the way, this is my older brother, though he may not look it, not much older, Dr. Anton Bilczyk. It is always a pleasure, Anton. I learn so much from you every single time. We have had a remarkable response from our podcast, Live Long, Live Strong, Live Healthily. Share it with your friends. It's available on Apple Podcasts. If you're listening to it live now, we'll put out the link. And again, I know, Anton, you are just so dedicated to try and educate people because so much of what you see and so much could be prevented if there was better education. So message for the week is to be healthy. Your message to anyone watching right now or listening to our recording is what for the week?
Is stay well, stay happy, and hi, Mom.
And hi, Mom. Thank you so much. I'm Nadia Bilczyk. My website is nadiaspeaks.com. You can reach Dr. Anton Bilczyk. If people want to know more, you work where, or if they want to have a consult with you, or if they want to find out more, I know you have an Instagram. We need to get you better set up on LinkedIn, but you can always email me and I will pass it on to Anton. I'm Nadia at nadiabilczyk.com. Thank you, and have a happy and healthy week.